Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer, and it is my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Elaine Bowen, who is serving as our worship associate. And also, if you are new to our congregation in the recent past and would like to have an opportunity to have a bit more of a conversation than coffee hour or greeting me and the worship associate in the receiving line each Sunday allows, we are starting a meet and greet once a month. And Karen Lapidus, our Director of Religious Education, a member of our Board of Trustees, and I will be available for 15 minutes from 10:45 until 11 here in the sanctuary to have a conversation, to get to know you a little bit, and to tell you a little bit more about the congregation. So if you would like to participate, just join us up here. You're welcome to bring your tea or coffee, and we'll have a little conversation.
Think about change. Think about the way change flows through our lives like a river. And then remember the wisdom of the Zen saying, it is impossible to step into the same river twice.
I live in the dark, in the moist, warmy earth, compact within my layers of self. The sun warms from above. I drink the cool rain of March. I hibernate and incubate until it is time. Time for what? Until it is time to reveal myself. My change is a slow process, and this change is not my choice. It has been ordained by my mother, Gaia. Sometimes her plan is interrupted by hungry creatures, too much or too little rain or sun. But most of the time, her plan is successful. She coaxes me to reveal myself with a strong and flexible arm of green that reaches up through the earth toward the sun. At the end of that arm is my hand, which I open to say, "Hello, world. I am here." My petal fingers dance in the wind, and my brilliant yellow trumpet sings to all who will listen, to all who can hear my song. Hello, world. I am Daffodil, and I am here. Come, let us worship together.
Love inside you. Go on your way in peace. So shine that light. This whole world now awaits you. Go on your way in peace. You've got the light of love inside you. Go on your way in peace. So shine that light. This whole world now awaits you. Go on your way. You know we hold you, we hold you, yes we hold you.
Our words of wisdom this morning come from Ohio native and revered poet Mary Oliver from her collection of poetry called Redbird. Oh, do you have the time to linger for just a little while out of your busy and very important day for the goldfinches that have gathered in a field of thistles for a musical battle to see who can sing the highest note or the lowest or the most expressive of mirth or the most tender? Their strong, blunt beaks drink the air as they strive melodiously, not for your sake and not for mine, and not for the sake of winning, but for the sheer delight and gratitude. Believe us, they say, it is a serious thing just to be alive. On this fresh morning, in the broken world. I beg of you, do not walk by without pausing to attend to this rather ridiculous performance. It could mean something. It could mean everything. It could be what Rilke meant when he wrote, "You must change your life." Let us join now in a moment of shared silence to reflect upon these words, or perhaps to meditate on the beauty of a tulip or a daffodil or a sprig of forsythia. Set aside that which is in your hands and that which is on your mind to welcome that which you find here this spring morning.
Each time we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care those we know who need our love and support. This morning, we remember Claudia Miller, hold her in our hearts. Her husband, Jim Harris, died recently. A memorial service in honor of Jim's life will be held in our sanctuary here this afternoon at 2 o'clock. And all are welcome. And we celebrate with Kay Clatterbuck and Mark Ekman, who were married here in our sanctuary yesterday afternoon in a beautiful, joyous ceremony, and extend to them our very best well wishes for a long and happy marriage. And I wish that I knew she had been coming today, because I would have arranged some kind of little ceremony. Renee Zimelis-Rohetsky, who is a member of our congregation and has been a student minister here, is currently a student minister at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Greater Canton and an intern at the First Unitarian Church in Pittsburgh, saw the Ministerial Fellowship Committee on Friday. That is a kind of akin to the last exam a person has to do in preparing for ministry, kind of a comprehensive oral exam, and Renee passed with flying colors. So congratulations, Renee. So next we can look forward to hearing the date of Renee's ordination. Spirit of life and of love, Spirit of mystery and wonder, we gather this new morning seeking only to be alive. All around us, life is calling out, new life bursting before our very eyes. Let it inspire us to be grateful for this gift that we have been given. In all its beauty, all its challenge, all its sorrow and struggle, life is a gift for which we are grateful. And because we are grateful, may we do all that we can to make this world, the people we touch, and our own lives a blessing for us having lived. May it be so. And amen. It's been almost 5 years since I moved to Kent, Ohio. In the first year, people ask me all the time how I liked Kent. Well, I've been here long enough now, and you know me well enough, that I feel I can tell you some things that I didn't feel free to tell you then. Moving is often quite challenging for me. Don't get me wrong, it usually begins with excitement and anticipation, and so it began here. But once some of the newness wears off and the reality of my changed circumstances in the world become a little bit more real to me, I typically get a little bit wistful for what was and a bit resistant to seeing what is. I remember when I moved from the rolling hills of western Massachusetts to explore new love and new work on Martha's Vineyard, a little island off the coast of Cape Cod. What's not to love about a little island off the coast of Cape Cod? And in the beginning, I did. Everything was wonderful and beautiful and exciting. But soon autumn came, and with it came my realization that the autumnal landscape was unfamiliar. Instead of the blazing gold, red, and orange of maple trees I looked forward to each year, scrub oak and pitch pine offered me a much more muted and modest range of rust-colored leaves. The trees got me missing the forest, and the forest got me missing for the hills, and for a while, everything was wrong. And then there was the move to Chicago. In the beginning was the stimulation of starting theological school and the challenge of learning to navigate in a big, busy city. But it really wasn't very long before I was noticing how the meager waves on Lake Michigan really had nothing in comparison with the waves and rhythms of the tides that I had grown to love on the East Coast ocean. So you see where I'm headed here. I came to Kent to take a great new job and moved into a lovely new house, but it really wasn't long before I began to miss what I had. And there you were, welcoming me to town and wondering how I liked Kent over and over. How do you like Kent? Well, it really wouldn't have done for the new minister to tell the members of her new church how unfavorably the new town compared to the places that she had lived before. The grocery stores aren't as good here as the ones in Chicago. The restaurants can't compare with St. Paul. There are no rolling hills, no seaside cliffs. So instead, I focused on all the things that seemed great before I arrived. The river's lovely, and the Cuyahoga Valley National Park is beautiful, and it's nice to be able to just walk downtown. And of course, in time, the more I said it and let go of what was and embraced what is, all of those things indeed became great in reality. Does this sound familiar to any of you? Even when we actively choose to change our lives, change is inherently unsettling. In fact, one psychological change theory suggests that feeling unsettled and making room in ourselves to feel our unsettled feelings is the first step of navigating any change. And mostly that seems right to me. But I say mostly because I've been thinking a lot in the last couple of weeks of how we deal with technological change. And I'm quite sure that there are some people who have very few, if any, unsettled feelings when they get to learn how to use a new piece of technology. Some of you are the kind of people who just think it's so fun to get a new Kindle or an iPad or a smartphone and enjoy spending time learning how to use all those new features. My partner's that kind of person, and she pointed out that I don't even know how to spell iPad as she corrected my spelling. She's the kind of person who, when a computer dies at our house, just thinks it's great to purchase a new one and learn about all its new features. I'm the kind of person, though, who finds learning how to use a new cell phone a hassle because invariably it doesn't operate like the one I had before, and thus, given this attitude, I'm also the kind of person who still carries a paper calendar. And then there are the sort of people, and I know that there are some of you in this room who have no idea what an iPad is or why anybody would want a Kindle and aren't really sure if cell phones are a good idea. So this little reflection about attitudes towards changes in technology makes me think that change is easier to deal with when it's welcome, when we believe that we can learn to master it, and when we feel we have some degree of control over the pace of change. I'm sure that there are some kinds of change besides technological that I could describe with those characteristics, but after staring at the page for 20 minutes and not being able to think any, I decided I'd leave it to you to fill in that blank. Most changes are unsettling. In the family systems literature, they talk about two kinds of changes. Normative changes are those that are an expected part of everyday life. Birth, death, marriage, entering school, entering work, retiring. Though common and predictable and sometimes even welcome, these kinds of changes often come with some degree of challenge or stress, both for individuals and their families. Non-normative changes are those that are unanticipated and not likely to be repeated, like traumatic accidents, natural disasters, losing a job, or even positive experiences like winning the lottery. These kinds of changes are known to cause anxiety and stress in people and their families, and sometimes even in whole communities. So how do we deal with the anxiety and stress? How do we deal with the persistent reality of change? Of course, it depends on the kind of change we're facing. As you reflect upon your own answer to that question, it might be helpful to consider some of the insights of the people who study change. John Weakland and Richard Fish are two of those people. As a result of their research, they've concluded that people tend to make two types of changes in response to changed life circumstances. First-order change involves simply adjusting to a new situation. Second-order change, though, entails a paradigm shift, a change in how we think about reality. For example, imagine a woman has become addicted to alcohol. If that woman were married to a man who made first-order changes in response to his wife's addiction, he might do things like try to get her to see a counselor, make excuses for her behavior when she misses appointments, manage their finances, and cover for his wife with their extended family. He would adjust his actions to adapt to the new reality of his wife's alcoholism. But if the man were to make second-order changes, he might go to a counselor himself. He might begin to see the ways in which his collusion with his wife's addiction isn't helping her, and he would practice letting his wife be responsible for her own choices, and he would practice being responsible for his. He'd change the whole paradigm through which he viewed the struggle he and his family were facing. Though making first-order change often involves stress, we make those kinds of changes with the sense that we have the capacity to adapt to our changed circumstances. But when we make second-order changes, we do so with the understanding that life as we know it has changed forever. Having children come into our lives and then having them move out of our homes to start futures of their own are both second-order changes. Getting married or divorced requires second-order change. The death of someone very close to us necessitates second-order change. Some people say that change always involves loss. I think that's this kind of change that they're talking about. Margaret Cornfield, a pastoral psychotherapist who writes about change, says that even when we believe that second-order changes will ultimately lead to happiness in our lives, we still experience loss. For example, parents who are proud to launch their children out of the family home into college or a career or military service often also feel grief over the loss of their familiar role. Second-order change is the territory of mixed feelings. The widow may feel sorry over the death of her long ailing spouse, but she may also feel relief that his suffering is over. How do we learn to live with the ambiguity that so often accompanies change? William Bridges is another change theorist, and he says that living with ambiguity, living through the ambiguity, involves at least three phases: endings, lostness, and new beginnings. The ending is the letting go of what was. The lostness is the empty time between what was and what might yet be. From that fallow time, new beginnings are finally born. It's important to emphasize the lostness section of this schema. John Shearer's model of change calls this passage through lostness the time of chaos. For transformation to occur, he writes, we must find ourselves released from the grip of the old context. This leaves us not immediately with a new pattern, but with empty space within which a new pattern can occur. In that chaos, we are open to what could show up, which could not have shown up as long as we were holding on to anything that we thought would save us from the experience of being in the empty space. To describe this kind of change, he uses the word transformation. That's a good religious word, transformation, from transformare to change form. I think it might be one of those elements that is universal among religious traditions. The Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh writes, a sangha, which is a Buddhist community, is real if it moves in the direction of transformation and helps its members develop lives of greater understanding, love, solidity, and stillness. I think we could also say that a Unitarian Universalist congregation is fulfilling its purpose in the world if it moves in the direction of transformation and helps its members bring their lives into greater balance, into greater alignment with their values. That's essentially what I told the youth who are participating in our Coming of Age class a couple of weeks ago when I met with them. As a religious body, Unitarian Universalists value the inherent dignity of each person and the interdependent web of all existence. We value compassion, the right of conscience, and the freedom to seek responsibly after truth. We value peace and the pursuit of equity and social justice. We value reason in religion even as we value the redemptive power of love. Week after week in our congregations, we come together with others who share our values. Our theological beliefs may differ. They will differ. They do differ. But we share the same covenant. It's our shared covenant that enables us to support one another's transformation. Like the Buddhist parrot, who changed hearts by awakening compassion and inspiring greater service. This isn't often easy. Sometimes in our congregations, we are the ones doing the inspiring, and sometimes we're the ones in need of inspiration. Church is a place to practice tolerating change, sometimes leading, sometimes following, and truth be told, sometimes lagging behind or even resisting. Church is a place to practice dealing with the ambiguity of change, to practice tolerating the lostness of change, to practice creating transformation so that together we can build the world we dream about. We do this for each other as individuals when we come together in chalice groups, adult religious education classes, at game nights, and over potlucks. We offer one another our attention, our support, our time. We do this for each other as members of the human family when we raise money for Kent Social Services or volunteer to pull garlic mustard on River Day or participate in a sacred conversation on race. We support one another's transformation when we work together to make our congregation and this community that we're a part of more healthy and more whole. Or as a lovely poem in the Chinook Psalter says, we make a forest of blessing, a ridge of blessings for the future to grow upon. Transformation. It doesn't call after us just once, but over and over throughout our days. Nothing in this life is static. Everything is changing. We are always changing. The world is always changing. The universe is always changing. Every day is a day of change. Today, in our corner of the universe, the winds of spring are in the air. Today is a day of change. How is it touching you, and how will you respond?
We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us to one and another, to the earth and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out to the world. Amen.